An apology from the minister who's currently abroad, and then the deputy minister is also unable to attend the meeting today. Those are the apologies.
Honourable Makar.
Sorry, Chair, there's just an apology from the Honourable Crading. He's just stuck in the meeting. The officials are in us in due course. He will join us, yes. Thanks, Chair.
Sorry, Chair, I just received one from Honourable Lowe as well. She will be joining us. She's just running about 10 minutes late, Chair. But she will be joining us.
So those are the apologies, so honourable members, I take it the apologies are accepted. So we are ready to get a presentation from Sanedi. Please, I know you'll start with the introduction, which is the most important part of this afternoon. So I want to know who's sitting on the left side of the house. The room? Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Go ahead. Honorable Chair, thank you so much, and good afternoon to you. Good afternoon to honorable members. I'm Kevin Nassif, the CEO of Sanedi. I just need to extend apologies at this stage for our chairperson, Advocate Nathemba Mlonzi. She was delayed in Johannesburg, but I do believe that she's on her way, so she will probably join us shortly. To my left is our CFO, Mr. Thabo Mwanamela, and then to her left is Mr. Varen McGann, who is the chairperson of the Board Audit and Risk Committee for Sanedi, and that's to comprise our delegation today.
Thank you. No, I don't have. I'm very interested in names today. Can't read some of the handwriting, including that one of Honorable Estevez. get the presentation from Sanedi. I was very just interested, honorable members, in the introduction part of the afternoon. So, Advocate Notemba Mlonzi, the chairperson, should be on her way. CEO Kevin Nasip is sitting here. The chair, Viren Megan, chair of the board of Audit and Risk Committee, and Thabo Manamela, the chief financial officer. And welcome, Honorable Law. We're ready to receive the presentation.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you for the opportunity to allow us to present our annual report to the committee. I believe the copies have been circulated to all members. I think I'll just extend another apology, and that is that the page numbers perhaps don't appear on the slide. So I know later on when there's questions and answers, you might be able to refer to a particular page, but we'll do our best to follow that. So the presentation itself is structured in the following way. We normally have to cover, and this has been a parliamentary requirement in the past, that we just discuss the actual production of the annual report in terms of its cost and its distribution, and then also to look very importantly at the achievements for the past year for the annual performance plan, and then to look also at areas where there's been partial or non-achievement, and to discuss first of all the reasons for that, and then to look at the corrective action that's been taken as a result of that. We'd also like to then look in particular at the financial performance of the organization, and the Chief Financial Officer will take us through that area, including the auditor's report, which will then look at some of the major audit findings and discuss not only the findings, but the corrective action that's been taken by the organization. We also have the Board Audit and Risk Committee's report, which will be tabled by the Chairperson, Mr. Viren Magan. So, Chair, that will be the structure of our presentation today. As I said, this is a requirement in the past in terms of how much has been spent, and the costs are given for the copies that have been made. We've kept it to 100 copies and a few, about 400 USB sticks, memory sticks, that have been produced as a result of that, and the costs for the hard copies as well as the USBs are provided. Each year we take the effort of trying to produce an annual report which is environmentally friendly, and that extends through to the paper itself, the ink, and also the way in which it's transported and packaged. So we do go to those lengths to try and ensure that we produce a sustainable product and puts in with our mantra, which you'll see in a little while. So the vision of Sanedi, broadly speaking, is to serve as a catalyst for sustainable energy innovation, the ultimate objective being that we need to support South Africa's sustainable development, particularly with respect to the energy sector. Of course, there's a nexus that looks at energy security, water security, as well as food security, and we try to ensure that there's a balance that's struck between all of those. The way in which we do that is through advancing innovation, particularly with respect to clean energy solutions, and we ensure ultimately that there will be a rational utilization of our energy resources into the future so that we can have a sustainable low-carbon energy future. So in a nutshell, if I had to define Sanedi in one sentence, it's the catalyst or facilitator that either funds or brings together the parties that are involved in the production of low-carbon technologies and ensures that they actually make it into the market and their jobs are created in the process. So there's no trade-off. Low-carbon technologies must create jobs, and that's the ultimate objective as far as we're concerned. We don't do this in isolation. We perform this with a variety of stakeholders, notably universities, but we also work together with the private sector as well as international donor communities and research bodies. Now, I'm going to take you through the annual performance plan and show you what has been achieved and what has been partially achieved or not achieved. And I'm going to spend more time on that, obviously, the areas where there's been non or weak performance as far as we're concerned. For the achievements that are there, I'd happily entertain questions at the end of the session with respect to the nature of the achievements. But I'd like to concentrate more on the areas where we think there needs to be more attention given to the outputs. So the first section deals with governance and administration, and the area which needs attention on the first slide would be under the area of compliance to relevant legislation, policies, and procedures. The major challenge for us during the course of the year was with procurement, and ultimately we produced our own procurement policy. Up until about July of that year, we were using the services of CEF, for supply chain management. And SIF has its own challenges with respect to procurement, and we needed to move our supply chain management processes out of SIF, and we were able to do that in July and put our own policies in place that talk to national treasuries prescripts in that regard. So that's been achieved, but as I said, it was only done during the course of the latter part of the year, and ultimately it is a partial achievement for us. The next area where there's levels of non-achievement, if you like, relates to firstly our marketing and communication plan. And the reasons why that's been delayed is that we took a decision that we had to have one holistic plan dealing with all the different types of technologies that we're involved with, so that's a consistent message that reaches the public. The reason for doing this is because we're also involved in the development of low-carbon technologies in the clean coal sector. So when we go to the public and we talk about carbon capture and storage, we're also talking to the same audience about renewable energy technologies, and sometimes they get confused because they think that we're pursuing different agendas, and yet ultimately it's one low-carbon technology development area that we focus on. So we spent a lot of time in developing the plan. It's now been produced. It has to be served before our board, and then it will be published. So that, for us, is an area where we needed to actually produce the plan during the course of this financial year. It's now being done. So the communication plan is there for the current financial year. The next area where there's partial achievement as well is on the area of carbon capture and storage. We've actually developed, in particular, a call for proposals in response to a call for proposals from the World Bank, where we've already established a project advisory committee that will guide us through the pilot phase, which is where we store carbon dioxide underground. That is intended for 2017 or 2018. There's a delay because the World Bank that's supporting this process has introduced new studies that have to be undertaken in preparation for that, and that takes more time. So we are behind schedule. We're about a year behind schedule as a result of all the extra studies. It's worth it because, as I'll mention again later, the World Bank has now pledged $27 million towards the program, and that complements quite well the allocation from Treasury, which is now being used to leverage money from the World Bank and the Norwegian government. The next area where there's partial achievement is on the shale gas side. We have a responsibility to assist government in the identification of the market, as well as the sustainable exploration and production of shale gas that will allow for an environmentally friendly process. That process has already started with respect to the studies that we're now undertaking on behalf of government. We had to wait for some time because of the interdepartmental task team that's been convened under the Department of Mineral Resources. Our responsibility is towards the Department of Energy, and as a result of that, in the new financial year, our work plan has been approved. However, the work plan as far as DMR initiatives are concerned, that is still awaiting approval from DMR. So we're all set to go. We've received our funding from Treasury for this, and already we've established a collaborative partnership with other entities that's going to do work in this space. There's not much to report on the next page. Everything in terms of ICT systems, everything has been achieved. We've now moved away successfully from SIF. We now run our own IT, our own ICT systems, in fact, independent of SIF. Same applies for the next page. So this also regards the telephony systems, IT support, all those functions that have now been transferred over to Sanedi directly. Another important area that's been on our books for a couple of years is the closeout of Sanedi. For honourable members that may not be aware, when Sanedi was established, it involved the merger of Sanedi as well as the National Energy Efficiency Agency. Both those entities had to be either deregistered or hived off. And in the case of Sanedi, in order to close the company and deregister it, we had to sort out an outstanding VAT liability, which is only recognized in the last year of Sanedi's operation at a point where it had not been budgeted for. Now, our CFO has been assessing the liability. We're in constant discussion with SARS. Unfortunately, the turnover rate in terms of SARS staff is so high that we battle to get consistent responses out of SARS. And what it means is we're not clear as to what the actual liability is. We're not sure if they're going to impose penalties and interest. Even though we are adamant that there should be no liability because the majority of the funds, most of the funds, have been spent on bursary support programs and educational projects at the university. So as far as we're concerned, those entities would not allow us to attract that in the first place, so we should be in fact be writing off those amounts. So it's an ongoing process, and we cannot close the books completely on Sineri until such time as we resolve that issue. Everything else on that page has been achieved. The next one is the South African coal roadmap, which is now being produced, and the financial management issues have been resolved and wound up. And you'll see for carbon capture and storage, quite a few projects have already been completed as detailed on the slide. So we now are ready, in fact, to proceed to the next level of study on the pilot phase. So everything else on that page regards the pilot phase, the pilot carbon storage project. And as you'll see, as I've mentioned earlier, $27 million has been allocated by the World Bank for the pilot, and $197 million has been allocated to National Treasury and the DOE. And, of course, the Norwegian government has now also pledged its support with an expectation that there will be far more support coming from the international donors as well as the private sector in South Africa. The other deliverables on that page also then relate to the pilot phase as well as the establishment of an advisory, international advisory committee that is guiding South Africa in the execution of the pilot phase. The one area where there is the partial achievement, and I've already alluded to it earlier, was on the implementation of the advisory committee recommendations, and I've said that it's in response to the World Bank call for proposals, and the idea was that those recommendations that have been made by the advisory committee must be done in partnership with the World Bank, and the World Bank has instituted its own requirements, hence the delay. And I just mentioned it wasn't the Pan-African Congress, it was the Project Advisory Committee in this case. Moving on then to other areas, for instance, the shale gas area once again. The shale gas investigation work plan, I have already alluded to the fact that it's been approved in this current financial year now by the Department of Energy. It wasn't as if approved at the end of that financial year. The Department of Mineral Resources still has to approve the balance of the plan. Moving on to the renewable energy space, and there's been significant progress made in the area of training and development in renewable energy, which I think supports very well the REBIT program, which is on the commercialization side. A number of key areas have now been introduced which supports renewable areas on the training front. One of them is a collaborative effort between ourselves, GIZ from Germany, and the Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University, where we've now established a training facility on PV, and we're now in the process of providing it with equipment, and in fact it's now well on its way in terms of developing capacity in the area of PV testing and installation work. So there's been tremendous strides forward. In terms of where there's been limited achievement, right at the bottom, the two areas, one of them is on a waste-to-energy hub concept. The whole idea is premised on work that was done at Wits University some years ago, where they developed a plasma-based reactor, which was called Beauty Fuel. And what Beauty Fuel did is it took biomass, it's a ton of biomass, and you could essentially produce a thin gas which would go into a mini Fischer-Tropsch process, so a scaled-down vessel inside of a container. That's the ultimate principle. And you can do two things. You can produce liquid fuels through a Fischer-Tropsch process with more environmentally friendly processes, in other words, reduce CO2 emissions out of the process, or you can just produce electricity. That's the other output. And the technology has moved from Wits University to UNISA and is now going independent. And we've had to work through these entities because there's intellectual property rights that have to be resolved in terms of ownership. So the project's been delayed because of intellectual property rights issues. We have placed our contract with Nexa. Nexa is the designer and the constructor of the plasma units. And so their inputs are critical, and so we are awaiting the actual production of the plasma unit. And thereafter, we'll be able to commission the unit somewhere in the country, most likely in KZN. We're already working in KwaMashu on establishing a waste-to-energy hub. The next issue is on a solar energy roadmap. It was scheduled for completion by the end of June of this year. So at the end of the last financial year, it had not been completed. It requires extensive interaction between government departments, notably the DOE, Science and Technology, as well as the Technology Innovation Agency. The IEA is helping to drive that internationally, but between all these entities, it's been difficult to get a synergistic view on a roadmap for solar energy, and that's why it's been delayed up until now. But it has been made available as of June of this year. And then also in terms of other areas where there's been limited achievement, in the area of the solar park, there's been some good progress made with respect to setting up measurement stations. So meteorological data is now being collected from these met stations. But the idea of setting up a test and demo facility has been put on hold, and it's been put on hold for financial reasons, but also because we'd like to make use of the smaller existing centres. And just a few months ago, Minister Pedersen herself actually launched a solar training and development facility in Upington near Salt Lake University. What's good about that is that we're now taking the skills into the area where the solar technologies will most likely be deployed. And so what we're doing now is we're trying to strengthen those facilities so that we can actually educate and actually build up skills in that area around the case municipality and other parts around Upington. So it's good work, but it's going to rely on an extensive network that's being set up in some of these smaller areas, smaller municipalities. One area where there's been limited achievement on the whole in Sanedi has been an area of smart grids, and I apologize for any typos that you see on the top. The idea behind smart grids is to eventually introduce a network in South Africa which is smart, one that can respond to the consumer's needs, allow for communication between the supplier of power, as well as to allow the consumer choice with respect to what they consume and where they consume it from. And setting up a smart grid takes time. It'll take us years. And we start off with a vision, a smart grid vision that talks to, firstly, what we're trying to achieve over a certain period of time, and what are the gaps in our knowledge, and what are the funding requirements to get us to a point where we can set up a smart grid. A smart grid cannot be rolled out in one go, so it's a phased rollout program, and you start off generally with the municipalities of Metro who have the best resources and actually have the capacity to support the establishment of a smart grid. Very importantly is that you also have smart meters, and some municipalities or metros have already started the process of installing smart meters, but a smart meter needs an infrastructure that supports it. What good is a smart meter if you don't know how to use it and you don't get value out of a smart meter? And it's all part and parcel of the work that we are doing. So the smart grid, in terms of the vision document, is with the Department of Energy. There were lots of questions raised about the type of work that's being done under the smart grid vision, and so we've been awaiting a support from the DOE for that smart grid vision. We do have industry support, so we've actually established SASHI, which is South African Smart Grid Initiative, and we have the likes of ESCOM and the AMEU and any other municipal utilities on board as well. All right, so you'll find that a lot of the deliverables that follow that relate to smart grids are pending because we are awaiting the decision from the department with respect to, first of all, the smart grid vision, and secondly, progress on our EU-funded program to roll out smart grids in 9 municipal areas. That program has just started, in fact, this week, so it's already 6 months overdue in the course of the new financial year, but had not been achieved during the course of the last financial year. So as you can see on the pages that follow, a lot of the deliverables that relate to smart grids, they're all pending, as I said, the approval of the relevant plans, all of them. So the business case, ICT requirements, policy requirements, everything. Moving on further down, you can see there as well the next 2 items are also pending. Moving on to Working for Energy, and that's a program that's been set up by government under the Expanded Public Works Program with the intention of providing energy to particularly impoverished rural communities, particularly projects where you can look up to developing up to 5 megawatts of power if you're providing power or gas or heat or energy efficiency. And as long as you're creating jobs in the process, it should meet the requirements for the program. So we've established a number of pilot projects around the country. The first few there are in the Eastern Cape, Malani and Fort Cox. And the focus there has been on the development of biogas digesters, where we actually train them to install biogas digesters using feedstock out of the community, and then we train them in bio-agricultural processes to produce agricultural products on a more environmentally sustainable basis. So we've made lots of progress on the Malani side, but we haven't met all our deadlines in terms of the projects, and that's because we are awaiting simple things like BE certificates, and these things take time. And if the university can't provide you with a PE certificate, then you don't start. That's how supply chain management processes work, unfortunately. So the next projects, like Fort Cox, that's been achieved in terms of the deliverables. We are now going to have the formal launch function happen as soon as the minister or the deputy minister is available to officiate. And we'd like to invite the MPs from this committee to also participate and actually see for themselves what's being done in the communities and see how they benefit from energy and the training that's been provided. So in some cases, like Ilembe and KZN, we have partial achievement or non-achievement, mainly because we're awaiting, as I said, administrative processes in placing contracts with service providers. But in the course of this financial year, I can report back that almost all of those digesters have now been installed. We're still working in a number of areas on schools, in particular Chirileko, which is in Kimberley, Orange Farm here in Gauteng, and others around the country in greening those schools and actually building digesters to help them with energy supply, but also to build up an awareness about greening. An outreach program was not finalized during the course of the financial year. The outreach program has now been developed and is now fully functional in the course of this financial year. So those are the deliverables under the Working for Energy program. In terms of our energy efficiency component, we've had tremendous successes on the energy efficiency side, in particular with the establishment, or rather the activities under our energy efficiency hub, which is now being converted into a center with the generous support from the Department of Science and Technology, as well as the ongoing support from the Department of Energy. So there you can see some of the numbers, the very good numbers that we've been getting. We have over 150 graduates in energy efficiency out of the University of Pretoria. They're not all students at the University of Pretoria. We tend to cast the net wide and get candidates from all over the country so that we can actually ensure that there's transformation in that sector as well. If you go on to the Income Tax Act, and we have two sections of the Income Tax Act that are relevant to us, Section 12I, which deals with a capital grant in the form of a tax deduction for capital expended in the course of introducing energy efficiency. And then you have Section 12L, which relates to the actual energy savings in kilowatt hours, where there's a tax deduction allowed for the actual energy savings. Now, 12L is already underway, and 12L has been introduced as of November of last year and is now fully operational, and there's been tremendous strides made in that area already. Of course, there's a big concern about the future of integrated demand management, which is the funding that's been made available past from ESCOM. That money is currently limited or depleted, and the expectation is that SENEDI has to play a leading role in the provision of some kind of assistance to industry to support energy efficiency initiatives. And the need is even greater at the moment, where we are looking at the potential for more supply constraint type activities like load shedding in the near future. Also on the side of energy efficiency, we have the Big EE project, which is in partnership with the Wuppertal Institute in Germany. Big EE relates to the provision of data, and really Big EE just means gathering big data, as it were, for energy efficiency, and the limitation there, of course, being the availability of data. We've already started with appliance data, but it's been delayed because of a lack of information coming from manufacturers. Everything else has been achieved under energy efficiency except for these last two, a national champion role for SENEDI. We have every expectation that SENEDI is expected to drive energy efficiency awareness and implementation in the country. The biggest challenge for us has always been that there are a multitude of entities in the public sector that are helping already to implement energy efficiency, and rather than duplicate, we need to ensure that A, there's coordination, and B, where there are gaps, that SENEDI plays a leading role in spearheading initiatives to support energy efficiency. So that process is being looked at. The Deputy Minister herself recently at the Department Strat Planning session has reinforced the need for SENEDI to drive energy efficiency. Ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to having a coherent plan which is shared with all stakeholders and which they buy into. So we're planning that in about February we will have a national workshop or conference in which we'll be able to detail the next level of activities and what SENEDI's role will be in terms of galvanizing efforts and also to actually spearhead some of the implementation itself. The last area, which is very important as well for 12I, 12L and other energy efficiency measures, is the provision of capacity for measurement and verification, particularly as there's a need to ensure transformation in the sector. There's only a handful of measurement and verification practitioners in the country, and we're trying to ensure that there's a broader spectrum of service providers that are trained in this area. So we're establishing a national MNV center at the University of Pretoria, which will be housed under the National Energy Efficiency Center that will be based there, and the expectation, of course, is that that will be achieved in the course of this financial year. So I think, Chairperson, let me just conclude on my side with a few highlights, just for the benefit of members. 12L has been a tremendous improvement on what else has been made available by the state up until now. The tariff is relatively low in the opinion of the private sector, but the instrument itself is proving very valuable, and we now have a large proportion of industry looking at how to benefit from this income tax benefit that's been introduced by Treasury and SARS. We've taken the successes of the hub and spoke model, which has been applicable in the case of the University of Pretoria, and we're now transforming that facility into a full-blown centre for energy efficiency. So it'll develop capacity, it'll undertake projects, it'll test products, it'll become a support function for standards and certification, so a really fully functional centre around energy efficiency inside of Gauteng. The other important issue is the technical advisory facility, which we've now established for energy efficiency with the generous support of the French Development Agency, AFD. That facility is now being made available to the financing institutions such as APSA, Nedbank, and IDC, and anyone can bring a project on energy efficiency to us, and we'll be able to assist them and the banks with respect to how to get that financed. We've established a cool surfaces association with the private sector. The intention is to roll out a program on cool roofs and cool surfaces. You can save up to 30% by the application of a special coating on your roof, and that's at low to no cost if one considers the overall cost on construction in any case. We've also secured the World Bank funding for the pilot phase, as I've mentioned to you, that's $27 million that's been made available through the UK government via the World Bank. We've also secured collaborative partnership with the City of Johannesburg for the production of biogas, which will be utilized in public fleet vehicles. And then we've also developed in partnership with the City of Tshwane a high-mast lighting retrofit program to introduce energy efficiency in high-mast lighting. Another spin-off benefit of this project is that we're able to introduce a Wi-Fi hotspot in the area where the high-mast lights are located, and the ultimate objective is to create an e-learning platform for those communities, particularly in the Soshanguve area, which is where the pilot is. And with that e-learning platform, we'll be able to provide educational materials free of charge into those communities. Komashu has now moved to the stage where we have a collaborative partnership with the Isiqhwini Metro, and the idea is to set up a waste-to-energy pilot converting sewage to electricity and following that up with the conversion of waste to other forms of energy as well. The last two I'd like to mention is the ongoing success around Saratech, which is the Renewable Energy Training Center, which is housed at CPUT here in Cape Town, generously funded by the Department of Higher Education and Training, as well as GIZ, and supported by Sinedi and Green Cape in this particular instance. Lastly, very importantly, is the establishment of a co-generation platform so that we can actually utilize waste heat, waste energy, producing electricity and heat or cooling power in the form of tri-generation. And we've now established a platform in which industry can work together with government in getting a rollout program for co-generation type projects launched in the country. And so industry is now chairing this co-generation platform, and our role is to facilitate the interaction with government so that, A, we can have projects registered under a REBIT program, but also take care of smaller scale projects under 12L of the Income Tax Act. So thank you, Chair, and with your permission, I'd like to hand over to the CFO for the next part of the presentation, which is a report back on the financial aspects around Sinedi.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Chairperson and honourable members, just going to touch on the financial side of things and also on the audit report from the AG. Just on the finances, during the previous financial year, what we had was we had a total of 295 million that we actually received the Sanedi, or we had in the bank account to actually work with towards meeting our objectives. We just want to highlight the split of the income in terms of the different sources of the income. We get an allocation from DOE for 63 million for administrative expenses, and then we also receive funding from the DST, about 5 million towards our CESA project, and also we also receive about 2 million of that 5 million from the DST towards energy efficiency, and then also we received 69 million towards the pilot project, as Kevin has spoken to, and also we had about 2 million towards shale gas. And then the other monies that we actually receive money from foreign donor institutions, as Kevin has said, towards our other projects that we're doing. We have like our WASA project. We also have money that we've received from the Danish towards energy efficiency. And then private sector, we receive money from also entities like Exxon, Alstom, Petro SA, towards membership fees into towards the pilot project as well. They pay membership fees towards the pilot project. And then we receive other income. This is basically, majority of it is interest that we get on the money that we have in the bank account that we invest through money market. And then 125 million was from previously received funding for the SACCS project, for Working for Energy, and also for the WASA project. Roll-over funding for admin, from the admin side, which is basically roll-over from the previous allocation for administrative purposes, was about 8 million. Okay. So if we move on to the next slide, just to show a picture of exactly how much of the money that we received is earmarked towards projects and how much of it is actually for administrative expenses. If you look at the picture, we only get about 24 million of the entire pool of money that we have is used for administrative purposes, and then 76% of that is actually the ring-fenced funding that we cannot use for anything else other than exactly what the funding is for. We will get a contract from whoever's funding us, and they will say this is what you will use the money for, and whatever interest that we receive on that money, it actually goes back into, I'll call it a trust account, so like a trust fund, so it doesn't even go back to Sanedi, and we also do not get like a management fee currently on those monies, but we are looking into in the future actually for this project to actually get like everything between like a 8 to 10% management fee. Okay. So that is just a picture of how we are currently funded. Okay. And then just on the spending analysis, we spent about 92 million in the previous financial year. That 92 million being made up of, if you look at our income statement, maybe just for the numbers to make sense, we actually have just taken the total expenditure for the entity. We've taken the capital expenditure along with the operating expenditure that is showing in our income statement. So we spend about 92 million all in all, and then we have to unfortunately surrender 71.8 million to the RDP fund, because in terms of the RDP Act, if the money is not spent by the end of the financial year, the money has to be surrendered back to the RDP fund. And as Kevin has mentioned previously, we actually have received the money back in the current financial year, and we actually have just concluded agreements with the municipality, and the project is up and running. And then unspent funding of the whole pool of money that we had was about 131 million, and then just a majority of it, or the bulk of it, has to do with the CCS project, which unfortunately, because of the additional requirement from the World Bank, we can only implement that in about 2017-2018. Okay, so if we move on to the next slide. Next slide is just basically explaining the whole spending, which I've just already spoken to. And then just the other challenges that we're facing in terms of our spending is we also have challenges in actually getting the project plans approved on time, because of once the project plan has been approved, there is in some instances public engagements that need to take place, and also we need to go out on open tender and then also to secure suppliers as well. So that takes time, and sometimes we actually run out of time, and then we end up sitting in a situation where we actually have to send money back into the RDP fund. Okay, next slide. Okay, just in terms of our spending in comparison to our achieved targets, I just want to highlight just in terms of the targets achieved, how we get to that percentage, is we've just taken purely the number of objectives versus what was achieved or partially achieved, and just looked at it, just only what was achieved. So if ever it's been partially achieved, it hasn't been included in the percentages achieved. So just to give you an indication. So in terms of the administrative expenses, we spent about 63 million. Kevin has already explained to say we had some challenges with Saneri, with the VAT issues which we were in the process of sorting out. And then for clean energy solutions, we had budgeted around 11 million. We've achieved about 82% of our targets and objectives. And Kevin has also explained on that, just to say why we did not achieve on some of the other targets. For smart grids, Kevin has already touched on it to say the project was put on hold and we are waiting for clarity from the DOE as to how to proceed with that particular project. On the EE side, we had budgeted about 5.5 million for the whole of EE. Kevin has touched on the Section 12L and 12I that we're doing. We also have the DEE and EEDSM hub, and we also have the FDC component of the EE project that which was not budgeted for when the initial budget was done. So if you look at the numbers, it looks as if we've overspent, but as a matter of fact, it's because of the FDC component that now came in that was not initially budgeted for. And then on the AFF and CCS side, budgeted about 216 million, but unfortunately, as we've already indicated, there's additional requirements, so we cannot proceed with the actual implementation of the project until we have concluded those studies that the World Bank has indicated. So we've incurred expenditure of about 7.9 million for the financial year. Okay. And then with an achievement of 83% of our targets. And then for the working for energy, we had budgeted about 3 million. We spent about 2.3 million on those projects. We achieved only about 40% of the targets. Kevin has already explained the challenges that we face, especially with WFE and achieving our targets. Okay, we can move to the next slide. Okay. Skip that as well. I think I've spoken to that. Okay, that, just in terms of some of our achievements, Kevin has already spoken about this as well. It's just the fact that we're able to leverage the money that we currently hold to actually get support or attract support from the World Bank, Norwegian government, and other donor entities, because they're also seeing the money that we are holding as an indication of support from the South African government. Can you move to the next slide? Thank you. And then just on the commitments that we have in the financial statements, we have a list commitment of about 9.3 million. We have a list of 5 years for our current business premises. I think we still have 3 more years to go. Yeah. And then we also have commitments of about 1 million. That is just for our ERP system. There are certain phases that we still need to implement, mainly the HR side of things. So that is only going to take place in the later part of this financial year once we have actually filled our HR vacancy. And then just on the project commitments, we are looking at about 21.8 million. 19 million of that being for the Working for Energy program, which we are looking at implementing those projects towards the end of this financial year. And we have actually gone out and opened tender to actually for some of those projects to be implemented. For clean energy solutions, we had a 2.5 million commitment. That is our contract with NERSA. And then smart grids, that is our membership fees to the ISGEN. Next slide. Okay. Just on the irregular expenditure, we had about irregular expenditure of about 6.4 million for the current financial year. If it's a comparison to the previous financial year, we actually have gone down by about 49.8%. And what we've tried to do is just to show you a picture of exactly what was incurred because of current year procurement processes and what was incurred because of previous year financial, procurement processes. Kevin has already mentioned that last year we had a service level agreement with SEF, so they were doing all our procurement, so you can understand that the two entities are not the same. We are a Schedule 3A, they are a Schedule 2, they are not bound by certain procurement rules, so unfortunately, the procurement was being done under Schedule 2 rules, so that's where we got it wrong. But in the current year, as early as July, we actually terminated the contract, implemented our own procurement controls, and as a result, you see that drop in the regular expenditure. And also, if you just take out irregular expenditure as a result of last year's procurement processes, we actually had about a 73% drop in our irregular expenditure, and we actually intend to keep that trend going. Thank you. On the audit report, we had an unqualified opinion with findings on performance information, non-compliance findings, and also on the internal controls. next slide, please. Just on the predetermined objectives, what I just want to highlight here is just the root causes, some of the main issues that we actually have identified ourselves, and then we actually are going to be our focus areas in terms of making sure that going forward we can achieve clean audit outcomes. The challenge is still, there's still a gap in between the people setting the objectives and exactly what is required. And there is also an element of subjectivity, but we are looking at just narrowing that gap, because the person who is setting the objective and the person who is actually doing the review in terms of the SMART criteria are the two different people. So we're trying to get the people who are setting the objective to understand exactly what the National Treasury is requiring of them. And then we're looking at getting our internal audit department to do a complete review of the objectives, the targets that are there, and then just to do a session with all the senior managers and explain to them this is where the gaps are, so we can just bridge the gap. Okay. And then we also had some findings on compliance. On compliance, was the first one was the audit committee, that the audit committee had less than 3 members for the financial year. Fortunately, we had a review that had to be done by the executive authority at that point in time. I think it was around the time that Ben Martin came into office, or Honorable Ben Martin came into office, and then there was a review that was done of our board and also of our audit committee, and as a result, that process took a bit longer than expected, and we ended up not having the vacancy that was there filled on time. But as said, at the end of the financial year, actually in October, we actually filled all the vacancies on the audit committee, and we had appointed an additional member who was an independent member with the financial background. So our committee at the moment, there's no compliance issue. Okay, just on the material adjustments to financial statements after submission, or also the asset management. The first problem that we have is we were migrating from our old financial system to a new financial system, and unfortunately, that whole migration process was not completed in time for us to actually do our year end and also prepare financials and submit to audits. By the 31st of May, actually, we had actually reconciled all our accounts, but unfortunately, most of the adjustments could only be made in June, so that's why we had a spike in the number of adjustments made to financial statements after submission. And then secondly, what we had to do because of that whole delay in the migration, we had to rely on a lot of manual versus automated controls. And unfortunately, for example, we had to do like financial data manually, and then we also had to do like a fixed asset register. Everything had to be created manually so that we can actually end up with a set of financial statements that balanced. So those are some of the challenges that we faced, and we also had some vacancies in finance which had been filled by the end of the financial year, and to date as well, we've made sure that all key vacancies in finance have been filled. Next slide, Kevin. Under procurement, I was already highlighted the SLA that we had with staff from the previous financial year, and then we also had a challenge because we were moving with people from Saneri, which was previously scheduled 2, and now we need to bring them up to speed with what is required when you are a scheduled 3A, the additional procurement requirements. But we have managed to bridge that gap as well through training. We've introduced new policies, and we've also, with the implementation of our new system, is actually an integrated process. Procurement is involved in the whole process from the placing of purchase requisition. It has to go to procurement so they can make sure that all the checks and balances are in place before we actually place an order for any goods and services. So we're actually controlling that. And then also we had an issue with our procurement department, or the procurement of goods and services being decentralized. So we had a lot of line management or line user involvement in the procurement where it was not centralized and going through one point. So like I've mentioned, with our ERP system, everything has to go through the procurement department before it actually goes out there, before we actually even place an order. Okay, next slide. Alright, in terms of financial misconduct, we had nothing. And then on the fruitless and wasteful expenditure, the 2 million that you have sitting there, if you look at the financial, my apologies, 2,000 that you have sitting there is actually from the previous financial year. We just need to get it condoned by the board, and we will have no fruitless and wasteful expenditure. For the previous financial year, we had no fruitless and wasteful expenditure. then just on the Audit and Risk Committee, I will hand over to our chairperson of our Audit and Risk Committee to take you through the slides. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chairperson and Honourable Members. It is a pleasure to present the Audit and Risk Committee report to you. Firstly, in terms of the PFMA, Senate is required by the Board to have an Audit and Risk Committee, and essentially we are the eyes and ears of the Board, and we make sure that management are kept on their toes. As you can see, the fruitless and wasteful expenditure and the other things that were mentioned by the CFO has been substantially reduced from year on year. So it's congratulations to the CFO who had been appointed, I think, in April last year, March. Well done from the previous year, anyway. In terms of the committee, I think CFO had highlighted that we were short of two members, and I'm glad that we have a composition of representation, not just from finance, but from the business as well, and that we have in the form of representation from DOE and DST. We are required to have four meetings a year, and which we have complied to. The areas that we focus on as Audit and Risk Committee are around governance, which includes internal audit, risk management, review of the financial statements, liaisons with the Auditor General, and general compliance in terms of PFMA. Next slide. In terms of external audits, yeah, we had extensive involvement with external auditors, and obviously with the tight the budgets and financial constraints in terms of current fiscals, we pay particular attention to their approach and methodology to the way they do the audit with a view of savings on audit fees. And I think we have also forged a very good relationship with the Auditor General, and they have been very supportive whilst the performance of their duties and the conduct of the last financial year audit. Compliance reports. The committee reviews all compliance reports produced by management and, again, representation back to the Board. Some of the matters that were highlighted through the discussions in the four meetings, the issue of the Audit Committee membership, and that's been sorted out. Irregular expenditure, again, we touched on that earlier on. And the vacancy of the company secretary has also been highlighted back to the Board. In terms of some of the control measures that have been implemented, I touched on that in my introduction, the appointment of the CFO, who hails from the ex-Auditor General, so I'm pretty sure that she's going to have a good year this coming year. In terms of internal controls, you know, there's been a significant improvement in the internal control environment from year to year. I can confirm that management pays heed to the recommendations of this committee, and we have vigorous processes and rigorous engagements with management in terms of ensuring that all recommendations either made by us as a committee or from the auditors have in fact been remedied and implemented, and follow-ups are being done to ensure that those issues don't recur. So, the financial information, again, significant improvement in terms of its reporting back to the committee. Our duty as the Audit and Risk Committee is to recommend to the Board to consider the financial statements presented by management on a quarterly basis and for approval. We've had systems issues and the CFO had touched on that, so I won't go any further into that. Next slide. Financial adjustments, I think again the CFO had touched on. However, it's very important that we pay attention to issues around policies, procedures, and training of individuals within the company, within Canadi. People come and go, and when new people come on, one of the weaknesses that happens is the guys aren't up to speed with the current policies and processes. And that's something I think from a finance point of view has to be looked at with some authority. Some of the highlights for the year, we are fully compliant now with the Audit and Risk Committee. We've reviewed a number of policies and procedures throughout the year, and them are now going to be submitted to the Board for approval. We've looked at the audit findings register. We've created a template for all findings, both from internal auditors, from external auditors, and ours. And we review those extensively on a quarterly basis. The IT governance documents have all been submitted and are going to be approved by the Board soon. In terms of risk management, risk workshops have been undertaken, and continuous review takes place of the significant risks that are facing Canadi. risk management function has been implemented. CFO touched on vacancies in finance, procurement, independent reviews by internal audit of objectives. One of the areas I think that requires significant improvement is the way performance information is reported. And in general, you'll find that the Auditor General are raising issues around performance information. And again, I think the CFO touched on initiatives as far as improving the processes around reporting on performance information. And I'm sure that will add value as you move along. Okay. Thank you.
Just on our audit findings, we've just performed a review, just done a comparison looking at last year's findings, this year's findings, and unfortunately the picture doesn't look as good as we hoped, especially on matters affecting the audit report, largely from the fact that we actually had to do a number of adjustments only after the financials were submitted because of the problems we had with our migration from our old system to our new system. Yeah, so unfortunately that picture is not a very good picture, but we intend to make sure that next year the picture is a lot different. Just on the next slide, we reviewed, had a look and looked at where most of the issues were coming from, and you will see from there that the majority of the findings actually originated from finance, and again, as I explained, the whole migration unfortunately didn't go as well as we had hoped, and we didn't finalize it in the time frame that we had hoped to finalize it, and we ended up sitting in that position there. Okay. And then just in terms of the root causes, I think it's important that we look at the root causes of the issues instead of looking at the symptoms, because then we won't be able to deal with the real issues. We'll just continuously be treating the symptoms. Firstly, as I mentioned, the delays, the migration, and the adjustments of the financial statements. The SLA was also another major factor for us, especially on the irregular expenditure, so that has been cancelled. And then the other issue is we still have an SLA. We remember when we moved away at Saneri, we were still largely dependent on CEF for some of the services, so they still render some services for us, especially in finance, some areas in finance, in treasury, and also internal audit, and also in HR. So we still need to move away in terms of those areas. So what we have currently is we still have challenges with that SLA, and we're in the process of actually appointing our own HR, in-house HR manager, so that we can move away from that SLA. So we're doing it, but we're doing it piecemeal in stages. And then the other issue is the lack of understanding, unfortunately, from the people setting the objectives to certify what is actually required in terms of law. Okay, just in terms of our audit findings, we also just want to highlight to the committee what has been done to date in terms of dealing with the audit findings. There are 37% of our findings that have been closed. My apologies, I see we've lost some data on the slides. Okay, and also we have some audit findings that are in progress, and also the red just indicates what hasn't been closed to date, what hasn't been done. That's all pending. Okay, thank you. That's all pending, and we still need to formulate an action plan for them. Mainly in that area is our performance information issues, and also the HR. HR is largely dependent on us having our own in-house HR department, because then we'll have control over the appointment of employees, what goes into their files, so we can implement data controls and we can be able to influence that process, because currently it's all being done by CEF. We don't have control over that, and it's challenges that we're trying to resolve with them. And then whatever is in progress, we have formulated an action plans for those. For example, with the policies that are due to be approved by the board, so the board meeting has been scheduled for next week. So once those are approved, then they will move into the closed category. And then just on the audit findings also, we just want to highlight just for the different areas, what has been pending, what is pending, what is in progress, and what has been closed. Most important for us is to look at those areas that had an impact on the audit report to make sure that we actually don't have those repeat findings, and we actually are able to present the clean audit report. And if you look at just the compliance findings, we actually had one that was in progress, and we had actually closed three. The one that is in progress has to do with the irregular expenditure, because the irregular expenditure has to be condoned by the National Treasury. Until such time that is condoned, unfortunately, we're going to have to continue reporting irregular expenditure. We give you an example. One of the things that were procured by the old staff system was our lease for the building. So annually, we're going to have, until that irregular expenditure is condoned, we're going to show irregular expenditure for the rental that we're paying for that lease. So that is something that we're trying to do with the National Treasury, so they can condone it, and then we can stop reporting it as irregular. Okay, and then just to highlight also the pending audit findings, I've mentioned the HR vacancies. We've advertised, we're going to be conducting interviews, and we're hoping that we'll have that vacancy filled by November. And then we're also in the process of appointing an accounting firm to reconcile our donor finding accounts. One of the challenges that we had is that in the beginning, when we moved away from SANAD, first doing our accounting systems, and we just want to go back to the beginning and correct a few errors that we initially picked up in how we accounted for some of the donor funds. And then thirdly, we're going to conduct an independent review of all our performance objectives so that we can align them. We will be doing a resubmission to the executive authority to say, okay, fine, these are our objectives, we've just aligned them. So we align them to make sure that they are actually comply with SMART principles. And then the other one is that all the senior managers, people involved in the setting of objectives, will be trained, because that is key. As long as we haven't trained them, we're going to have a recurrence of the same problems, and year on year we'll keep having findings on performance information. And the last one is that we've actually done a review based on our action plan. We will have actually everything that is said to be in progress closed by the 30th of November. I'll hand it
over to Kevin. Thank you, Chair. I'm going to start summing up at some point soon. Certainly from our perspective, we've been asked to also concentrate on how does the CNEDI provide integral value to various policies and plans, both within government and also internationally. And as far as Millennium Development Goals and the new Sustainable Development Goals, certainly CNEDI has already been instrumental in supporting initiatives like that from a South African perspective. And so our mandate, which is heavily centered on energy R&D, innovation, as well as energy efficiency, really talks to flagship programs under our climate change response strategy, national development plan, as well as even under the State of the Nation address and also the Minister's budget vote speech. So there's complete alignment in respect of policy and plans both nationally and internationally. And our goals that have been developed for CNEDI really talk to those areas, and so you'll find that we've really developed three strategic outcomes. One of them is to really enable decision making at the highest level by making available information in the form of data, in the form of R&D outputs, etc., that allow governments to make informed decisions, to also facilitate this acceleration to an accelerated transformation to a low carbon future, and one which is less energy intensive. And then also lastly, to create a culture in which we use our resources more sustainably, in particular with respect to energy, but also including water and taking a food security perspective into account as well. So this table really just reflects on issues such as the Integrated Energy Plan, the National Development Plan, Integrated Resource Plan, and really looks at some of the key areas that are contained in those plans and what CNEDI's role is in terms of supporting that. And so, for instance, on the IEP, where you can see the large focus in terms of renewable energy, you can actually see that it's carried through in the NDP and the Integrated Resource Plan. So it's a constant theme that runs throughout it. And of course, I already mentioned to you what our activities are in respect of trading and development. We're also supporting, as I said, in the Northern Cape, the installation of centers that are focused on testing, demonstration, as well as training. And then you can see for wind as well, we have our Ceritech Center with other international partners, that we are actually playing a role in that space. WASA is the wind atlas for South Africa. So it's a brand new atlas that pinpoints all the key locations around the country where wind project development is possible. And then also where, once again, with respect to renewable energy, helping to develop the appropriate fiscal instruments to support not only renewables but also energy efficiency. And so we're working with National Treasury to introduce more and more tax-based instruments to assist in that regard. Energy efficiency and innovation in that respect is an ongoing challenge, and I said to you, coordination is the key here. but it's something that's being called upon by all the plans to ensure that we have adequate information and also adequate interventions regarding energy efficiency. Just some of the last slides, really just a push towards a green industrialization program in South Africa. We've looked at models such as China's, but you can also look at Korea. You can look at Malaysia, and you can find common threads, and you'll see across cutting across all of them is the need, firstly, to move from a commodity-based economy to a knowledge-based one, and you invest in the appropriate infrastructure, and you make sure that the industries really talk to the long-term growth of that sector, and you make sure that you have appropriate skills and technologies, and that those are appropriately financed, and there are public calls, and that the public has a greater certainty with respect to the type of level of support that they will get, and they will in turn invest through the private sector players. So one of the few things that we've concentrated now in terms of developing a green industrialization plan together with like DGI is to look at concentrated solar plants. Concentrated solar power is in fact a term used for a number of technologies that harness solar power by concentrating the beams of sunlight onto a focal point, generating heat in the process, and that heat is converted to electricity. We have a number of projects under the REBIT program that are already in existence, and our role really is to try and develop a localization strategy, and we're intending to produce a plan under a new subsidiary that will be looking at the generation of intellectual property and then supporting the manufacturing of those components in South Africa. And one of the disconcerting things I saw, I went to the Abengoa plant in Carcamas as well as in Upington, and about 90% of the people on site are really are Spanish nationals, and they're employed by Abengoa, they're employed by the civil company, Avensa, and you find very few South Africans that have been incapacitated. And the few South Africans that you find on site, they have the same complaint, is that we're not doing enough as a country to support the localization in terms of skills as well as component manufacture. Even storage tanks for molten salt, the tanks, came in from Spain. And I have to ask myself, is that really the good use of our resources in this country? So yes, so CSP for us, a big area of development that we need to support. Fuel cells would be another area where there's a very good potential in South Africa to develop a fuel cell industry, and there are many others like that. But anyway, so training and development is critical on the agenda to make sure that we have the right skills, and the DGI, of course, is a critical player in that regard. So in terms of State of the Nation address, we have two main areas that we've pulled out, the shale gas, which is an ongoing area of development for us, and in the green economy issues, the broad green economy or blue economy, depending on what facets you're looking at. But certainly from our perspective, we are really aligned in as far as those areas are concerned. So I think this is just touching on very importantly issues around transformation at the entity, particularly with the focus on gender mainstreaming. And we align ourselves as close as possible to things like the Millennium Development Goals and ensuring that we promote gender equality and empower women. And you'll find that there's a fairly equitable split in the old racial classifications for the country. And about 52% of the staff, in fact, are females as well. And so we're doing everything in our power to make sure that we are fully transformed in the entity and that we carry that forward into the projects that we undertake to make sure that those are also fully transformed as well. So this is just on the management side, and you'll find that there's a fair split in terms of gender, but also in terms of racial classification. So we've tried to do our best to ensure that there's adequate representation. This is just a broader reclassification of our staff numbers, and you'll get a sense from this of where the actual numbers are. And that table was there for your information. Those figures at the bottom, like I said earlier, gives you 52% female representation, and you're starting to be disadvantaged about 73%. So yes, it's ongoing work. We're happy with the progress so far. Always can do more, but and the staff complement is 46 in terms of our permanent staff, but we have quite a few interns and contract workers, etc. I guess the actual numbers are just over 60 at the moment, and it reflects the same kind of demographics as well. This is a summary of some of the other initiatives that we are participating in. Techno Girl is one of those, where we take girls from grades 10, 11, and 12, and educate them in terms of our processes and what we do, and ultimately at the end of the day they will be in a position to choose fields of study, science, technology, engineering, and maths, in which they will be able to make a contribution in our space. So that's just a summary of the type of developments we're involved in at this stage. So So we have various, on the international front, we have various implementing agreements that we are party to, particularly under the International Energy Agency, but also under the Clean Energy Ministerial, the Carbon Sequestration Leadership Forum. So R&D is very heavily premised on what's available in the international market. So a lot of innovation is possible in our country, but so much more, so much more is happening on the international stage. The only way to access that cost effectively is to join into partnerships where a lot of that work is being developed and being shared. And also partnership agreements with industry as well as international collaborative partners is a good way of limiting costs. And then, of course, working with donors to make sure that we implement projects based on their particular requirements. So, Chairperson, with your indulgence, I'd just like to sum up by saying that the year that we've experienced, challenging in the sense that so much work has to be undertaken. A lot of what you've seen in terms of unspent funds is as a result of business plans that were pending approval during the course of that year. All the money that we're given to spend on projects that have been approved has been disbursed. It's simply a matter of making sure now as we move along with the stakeholders, all of them are aligned that they approve and the projects themselves will happen. So I need to leave you with that impression that it's all about making sure that the stakeholders agree before you can actually go out there and roll out. You know, many stakeholders, it's not just national government departments, it's also the metros. It's community-based organizations that play a role. And you have to have them all aligned before you can actually implement these projects. On the financial side, yes, we've seen that the levels of expenditure, we've seen what the AG report has said. We know we will conclude in terms of correcting all the findings by November. We will also endeavor, as I said, to make sure that the necessary attention is given to financial controls, because that ultimately is critical. The pleasing thing for me is the fact that irregular expenditure has come down dramatically once we've introduced our own systems, that there is no fruitless and wasteful expenditure during this course of this past year, and in no cases of financial misconduct, which I think is always a healthy sign for the organization. So that note, Chair, I'd like to thank you and the members for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honourable members, you're ready. I'm sure it appears that we may not need a break. Honourable Stacey, Honourable Matala, Honourable Lohu, Honourable Mohamed Sala, Honourable Makai. What did I say? Honourable Stacey, Honourable Matala, Honorable Lowe, Honorable Mohamed Salah, Honorable Makai, and Honorable Farco.
Break. We can have a break.
Honorable Esteza.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you to the Development Institute for the presentation. Everything that their mission is cleaner air, and that gets my vote of everything. Chair, if you'll bear with me, I've made fault as we paid as we went through and this and so on and so on. On the storage of carbon dioxide, that's a concern for me. I don't think the country can afford this at this stage. Right underneath the shale gas, which is basically the same thing, you'll have to drill wells kilometers deep into the earth to store carbon dioxide. And to do it to existing plants is going to raise the price with 90% of the energy produced, if not more. With existing, I think it will be more, actually, with newly planted up to the existing. So I don't think that's really, but we can't really put a price on clean air. So that's also said. Shale gas, basically, I've just mentioned that as well. So, just see where I've made another. Under the heading management of income, expenditure, transfer, cash and assets, rollover funding, 125,000. Rollover funding, is it not a case of use it or lose it? this was not used. Maybe the chief financial officer. This was not used. I know there is some rollovers that you can get permission to have it done. Unspent funding, which is a bit of a concern, 131 million. I'm very surprised, unspent funding, and 52% of the presentation is women. Tongue in the cheek, I'm saying that. Then under input to different sections of financial statements, lease commitment 9.3 million rand. This probably will have, and I'm saying this, I don't know, this will probably will have, it could be storage, it could be everything. Further down, that says that your total staff commitment is 8 people, permanent people. So 9.3 million rand, so that can't be just for officers, of course. Then under linkages with IEP, NEP and IRP, to increase the renewable energy technologies 26.3% to 20,000 megawatts. Yeah, I don't know. Is that not an unrealistic figure? We, you know, that 26.3, that should be about 80,000. That should be about 80,000 megawatt in total. You know, South Africa, this state only produced the total capacity, I think, is 35,000 megawatts. And this is in 15 years, you're talking from now. And all the projects planned won't even be commissioned in 15 to 20 years from now. That's the renewable energy. And it's also a problem. I know, I think it's called E.ON in Germany. They have a big problem connecting, as in South Africa, connecting renewable energy to the grid. And also, most of the people I know in Germany that produces renewable energy is losing money. I'm just saying that is wrong. And then, under the management, the general discussion on transformation of entity. Further down, I thought, just the next page, it says permanent staff 8, contract staff 38, that's contract staff, so that's not permanent staff, and that gives you a total of 46. So here, you've got a CFO, the company secretary is not called it. That's less than 52%. Or maybe Mr. Berenkamp or Mr. Mahuma or somewhere is also female, but then it doesn't give you 52% of the female staff. Okay, then on the next page I query that 8 and a 38. And that's also what I've mentioned on the lease amount. And that's me. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Chair. There are lots of things that one can raise in this report. It's unfortunate, Honorable Chair, that this report, in fact, is actually crying to us. It wants us to assist this day. They want to be assisted, in fact. It doesn't say anything, this report. So on the general discussion, transformation of this entity, Chair, the 52% that I say is actually not true. It's a rumor. Number three, they don't have the secretary. Who wrote this report? The chief financial officer has just been appointed 6 months. He has inherited some problems in this entity. So my suggestions, Honorable Chair, is that I was of the view that let's not discuss this report as it is now, because it doesn't tell us anything. There are flaws in this report, Honorable Chair. I would suggest that they go back, prepare a thorough report, which is not going to complain to the committee. And in the next, next year maybe, or that's before we go for recess, the entity must come here with a convincing, with a full report that is going to be discussed by this committee, not crying to us, not wanting us to assist them. If they want assistance from us, let them tell us to assist them. And they must not come here and cry fouls to this committee. To me, Chair, I don't know as to what is it that we're going to get and discuss in this report. It doesn't say anything, this report. Thank you.
Honorable Law.
Thank you, Chair. I was not sure, should I still answer my questions after hearing that? Because I also picked up some few concerns out of the report, and some of them I think is related more or less to my colleague on that side, and some more or less to my colleague on my right hand side, to the questions that they have asked of the staffing and so forth. My colleague on my right hand side. But I can recall previously when the entity came and report to us last time, there was an issue of some funding and so forth the first time. So I think we shouldn't be too quick to say, we shouldn't discuss the report and so forth. Because there were some issues, I know last time that they came and report to us pertaining to funding and staffing that they have reported to the committee. So I think for today, let's discuss the report. They came and present. Let's discuss it. Because as a portfolio committee that are doing oversight on energy and so forth, do we give proper support to going green or renewable energy? So let's discuss the report. I don't know, am I talking sense, Chair? So my questions to the entity would be on the technicians. Unfortunately, there was no page number, so that's why I said I could relate to him in some sense, because there's no page numbers now. I cannot say to on page what and so forth, but my one will be on the technicians that were trained in Germany. How do you ensure that these technicians stay within the entity? Because I remember yesterday we have one entity whereby they train staff and then it's are being absorbed by somebody else or some other industry. How do you ensure that these people are safe or stay within Sanedi or being observed within South Africa and they don't go overseas and go and find employment that side? And then on the lease one, the lease commitment, don't you think it's better to rather buy property than to actually rent out your property? What is your short-term, medium goals in terms of that? And then the ones of the schools and the clinics, the energy centers, what is your time frame there? When are you going to, because you didn't achieve it, when are you going to achieve it? What is your time frame there? So it's very crucial sometimes when you come and report to us to, because what I would like to see is what is your short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals for me for this next 5 years that I have to do as EFF oversight to your entity. So it will be crucial as well when you come and you report to us that you also enlighten that as well within your reporting. And then, yeah, I first just ask one concern as well to the staffing. What is your plan there to, because you have 17 black females, you have 9 white males, so there's still not a balance for me in terms of the colors and the Indians. What is your plan there to rectify those areas? But I'll also like to see some colors represented fully in your entity. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Jay, I don't know where to start. You know, when Elder Ye next to me spoke, I must just be honest and say I share the same sentiments. Since my arrival in this parliament in the last 100 days, this is the worst report that I've ever seen. Worst ever. I must be honest and just say it as it is. This report alludes to the vacancies in finance and the serious challenges of irregular expenditure. There's challenges of underspending and what have you. That's my first problem. Second problem, the vacancy of the most crucial person in the company, which in my view is more of a custodian, which is the secretary of the company. Amongst the responsibilities of the secretary of the company when it relates to Usanidi is to compile a risk management report as required, is to manage Usanidi's liabilities in matters of litigation, establish and enforce regulatory requirements for the conduct and running of board meetings, providing board members with guidance in execution or in executing their duties and authority. And this is missing. As the elder said, these reports that are presented here today, who really compiled them? Among the responsibilities of the secretary of this company is to review the code of ethics on an annual basis. And this is missing. You can see in the report that this is missing. The report tells us that the procurement has been taken over and controls have been implemented. I'm just confused. I need to be clarified. Lack of understanding of the basic principles and setting a predeterminated objective is amongst the findings
of the audit. Senior managers will be trained on setting performance objectives. Don't they understand how to do this? Because they are senior managers. The CEO, in conclusion, as he was presenting, he says there was no financial misconduct. It was none. Now, if you check the guideline on irregular expenditures, Section 38 of the FMA, it is written there in that guideline, requires an accounting officer to take effective and appropriate steps to, amongst others, prevent irregular expenditure. Were the steps taken to prevent irregular expenditure? I'm raising this because when the CFO was presenting the section which was she presented here, she says at least irregular expenditure is now 49%. And they intend to keep the status quo. Or it must just stay where it is now because there's an improvement compared to the previous financial year. Now it's better or it's right. I want to understand, in terms of the guideline on irregular expenditure, is it supposed to be there? Is it supposed to be better? Or there's supposed to be none in terms of this guideline that I've just referred to? Now, having raised all what I've raised here, as the elder said next to me here, the report reflects that there's a serious crisis in this SOE, a very serious one. It's written there black and white, right? And the people who were supposed to be there, I mean, here and present the report, there's only 3 years. The chairperson of the board is not even here. Since she was in Johannesburg Airport taking a plane coming to Cape Town, she has not arrived. The representation of you guys is problematic. It begins to tell us that you don't take us serious. We are the shareholders. Yeah. We are the shareholders, and that respect, it has to be there. That of a shareholder, if you can't respect the members of the committee, but you must respect the shareholder. Now, having raised all what I've raised, now I would like to know from the Sanity team that is here to present the report, because most of the things which are wrong or with gray areas, they blame them on self. And it's rather mischievous to blame things on self, because self is not here to defend their standing.
Now, I want to understand. If we were to convince the minister tomorrow to keep you in this company, what would you advise us to say after the report that you have presented? A very ugly one, indeed. What would you say if you were to ask the committee to convince the minister to keep you as a team? What would you ask us to say? Because the slide that you showing there, for me that slide means nothing. Because it's only numbers. The actual detail is on what you wrote on the report, things that we've read. Mathematics aside. Because it's not going to assist us. Irregular expenditure is there. Now, that's my submission, Che. You know, so I really need to be empowered that if this team of self was in my position, what would they say or do? Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Makai.
Thank you, Chair. I wish my colleagues in the committee would save this much veracity for things like Nkandla or 1.6 billion that is missing at the department, not just 6 million that have been halved in a 2-year period. It's very interesting that you've decided to draw or pull Finity over the coals, which is actually not a bad report. I disagree with my colleagues that the data is incorrect or not captured correctly. I think there are some inaccuracies, but largely what we can see is a vastly improved situation since the introduction of the new CFO. I have a few questions which don't relate to any of my colleagues. I'm specifically interested to understand, you spoke about Cogen. As far as I'm aware, what's holding up Cogen is the minister, specifically around the fact that Cogen wasn't actually included in the RFP 2010. It is included in the RFP 2010 update. And none of my colleagues on this committee have ever seemed fit to kind of put the minister to such a grilling to kind of explain to us where the RFP 2010 update is, which would, for example, unlock cogeneration and add about 800 megawatts to the grid instantly and create a number of jobs and deal with our carbon emissions problems. So I'm not expecting a clear answer from you in what the minister should be doing, but I would be willing to understand how your processes around cogen are relating to the very poor performance by the minister. I'd also just like to understand what is the solution to managing your rollover funding? Because right now, almost half of the money you have is from rollover funding, which means that although you guys are working quite hard on your projects, you're not actually getting them finalized or done because it's a huge component. I know you said it relates to one project, and I know you said there's certain constraints in terms of the law. But fundamentally, I mean, if that's going to be, you know, the stop-start approach that we have continuously, Sunet is going to be hamstrung for the future of its existence. So does the committee need to seek changes to the law? What is the assistance that Sunet needs to actually get itself up and going? Because, I mean, that's a large chunk of your money that is sitting ring-fenced waiting to be actualized and rolled out into projects. I also see, again, that the shale gas report that you submitted in 2013 still hasn't gone anywhere. Again, it's the failure of the minister, not Sunedi. And I just would like to understand, what is the nature of the report that was submitted? Obviously, it predates our time in the Fifth Parliament, but we are very keen to see some reports made available to us on shale and exclusively helping us lower our greenhouse gas emissions. So if you could just maybe give us some insight there. Again, I know it's not specifically in your area, and I know there is interdepartmental issues, but if you can just give us a broad understanding around Sunedi's relationship to shale gas and how that is preparing us for actual exploration. A question around, you did raise the issue, CEO, of the need for greater localization on a lot of these projects, while at the same time raising this issue around partnerships and saying that a lot of the action is happening through partnerships. Now, how do we balance those? How do we actually develop partnerships that allow us to actually drive localization? Because it strikes me that in the current constrained economic environment, international players are not going to give off pieces of projects to allow us for localization when they are going to want to do it for themselves. Spain, for example, has its own issues around growth in a constrained economy. So when we're talking about these partnerships, how does the NEDI actually facilitate that localization component? The final question I want to ask you is, because your fundamental job is to help us drive a green economy in South Africa. I know that you guys are a relatively new body, and I think you guys are making important strides towards this. But fundamentally, what the report doesn't really tell us in kind of a very succinct way is how SANEDI is actually doing against that objective. Yes, we've seen it against multiple sub-objectives, and there's a lot of detail in the report. But fundamentally, I think the committee does not have a full understanding or grasp of how SANEDI has actually done in helping us achieve these things. How is government facilitating these issues? And furthermore, what kind of support SANEDI needs? Because I think instead of trying to drag SANEDI over the coals, SANEDI probably needs more support, a bit more love from the Department of Energy, and probably greater support from the minister, who I think is deeply involved in nuclear and so is not so obsessed with greenery. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I also think there is room for, there are weaknesses, but there is room for improvement, and there has been improvement. My first question is, energy efficiency is fragmented. As an energy efficiency champion, what has SANEDI done to bring about integration and coordination? My second question is, the objections, I didn't get you, CEO, when you were explaining the misalignment between objectives, indicators, and targets. It's very unclear to me, because you get objectives from your strategic plan. So don't you know what is the strategy and create your objections, your objectives, and your indicators and targets out of that, out of your strategy and objectives. So it's very unclear. I want to explain further this misalignment. Thank you, Chair.
Trying to find out is to all those findings, have you got a mechanism prepared, in fact, to address those findings? Secondly, it looks like the entity is overpopulated by contractors, because you have 8 permanent staff, but almost 38 contractors. So I wonder if this entity will end up being owned by contractors who are actually working
opportunity.
Thank you, Chair. Just my last 2 cents worth. I also, one of the honourable members that haggle me when I criticise, I've got to agree with her today, that I think it's a lack of respect for all the, for the presentation to the chairperson, too arrogant to come here. But just nuclear, I just want to nuclear. Nuclear energy, I think, is also clean energy. That clean energy, it will create, and maybe again to my colleague here, I think the minister in her wisdom has maybe got us into nuclear now, and that maybe should have been mentioned in this. Nuclear clean energy will create a lot of job opportunities. We have the 100,000 jobs opportunities that Adelie, and I think it should have been in this report as well, that is also clean energy.
Okay. It's coming tomorrow. Your nuclear issues are coming tomorrow at 9 o'clock, Honorable. Is there that? But they can comment on that. I must say that initially I thought that we would meet the honorable members. No, you can't be not in a meeting. I'm saying I thought we'll finish it up as four is indicated here. So let's give Sanedi a chance to respond. I was not going to allow a break to grab something there, but now I will, after Sanedi's response. So let's give them to respond, and Sanedi, please respond to all the questions and comments. Members, I hope that we still finish just after first four. Go ahead.
Chair, I have received a message from the chairperson. She was booked on exactly the same flights as us. I have received the message that she has physical difficulties. She has a disability in her back. She has just landed in Cape Town. She landed early in Cape Town, but she's unable to join us because she's experiencing back problems. So I would like to just ask the committee to please understand that she has made every effort to be here. She's actually offered to refund her travel costs. She has shown the respect to this committee by coming here despite telling us that she's experiencing tremendous backache and she's gotten to go to hospital.
Wait. She did tell you before.
No, she told us that she's experiencing pain and I asked her to please join us if possible. She agreed. She was on the same flight as us. She was delayed in Johannesburg because she had to go and see a doctor.
That's all I wanted to understand. Oh, she had backaches already. Oh, okay, before you planned to come here. So it's not something that happened today.
No, she's arrived in Cape Town, but she's gone to hospital.
So I would just like to extend our apologies again to the committee, and certainly just to point out that it is not a respect issue. She had every intention of being here today, and she has been here in the past, notably to present on our strategic plan earlier during the course of the year. So she's fully committed to the committees, and please don't misinterpret her illness as being a sign of disrespect. I'd like to just take us through some of the questions.
Chef, on a point of order. No one misinterpreted any illness here, because we're never informed about any illness, Honorable CEO. Please.
Should I continue?
Can we take a break? I think we need a break, because I want you to respond in a manner that would have otherwise have responded earlier, just to the questions posed. So I know at this time we may need a break. Just 5 minutes, please. Where's Honorable Matar? Sorry, Honorable Members, I realize others have left, so we might not make 5 minutes. Okay, 10 minutes.
Okay. Day's 48, they don't get him. Day's 53.
Those people on that see they've got some paper.
Yeah,
I don't know where he is.
Yeah.
she has. We have written on that thing.
Just your phone number. I'm going to phone you and I'm going to come bring that little thing I told you about. And I'm going to show you everything. Hmm?
Yeah.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, no problem.
Bye.
Thank
you.
Sanelli, responses, please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chair, I'll go through them systematically as raised, if you'll allow me. In terms of the issue of storage of carbon dioxide, there's an extensive stakeholder engagement process that's underway to establish, in fact, what the public's perception is around carbon capture and storage. Not many people understand what's involved in the process, and the Honourable Member is correct that the costs are high. There's an energy efficiency loss, and there's a capital implication, which means that overall the levelized cost of electricity will go up. Nobody does CCS voluntarily. Our role as an AD is not to enforce the use of carbon capture and storage. It's to inform governments with respect to the cost implications and the regulatory framework that's needed to allow for the safe and cost-effective use of CCS should it become government policy. So that's really what this whole exercise is about. We try to limit costs by doing a pilot phase in 2017 or 18, where we inject tens of thousands of tons, bearing in mind your power stations are producing like millions of tons of CO2 per annum. We're talking about tens of thousands of tons of CO2 as a pilot. From there, we'll be able to establish more or less the effectiveness of the technology and then suggest that to government if indeed it is viable. I could just mention that the World Bank is supporting a number of initiatives around the world, including in Mexico as well as South Africa, and we're getting the lion's share of the funding, which is at $27 million, as a pledge towards South Africa's program to understand the implications of the technology. There's no pressure on us in South Africa to introduce CCS. We're doing this voluntarily. The only other country that has done something voluntarily in this regard is Norway through its Sleipner facility, which is in the north coast. It's the first CCS project motivated purely on environmental grounds. Everybody else that does CCS does it for what we call enhanced oil and gas recovery. So they inject CO2 into gas wells and oil wells, and then they actually extract out the gas, in particular using the heavier CO2. And the CO2 remains underground. So I just want to assure members that at this stage, nobody's committed to CCS. We need to understand the economic issues that and the legislative framework in which it will be introduced, and then a decision will be taken in that regard. And I think the same applies to shale gas, and I was asked also about the nature of our work plan with respect to shale gas. For us, it's very important as a research-based organization to answer a few critical questions. If you're going to proceed with shale gas, what is the most cost-effective way of continuing with exploration work in an environment which is environmentally sensitive? Secondly, to introduce environmentally friendly waterless fracking technology into that environment. So that is one of the biggest challenges, of course, is using fracking liquids, which are, of course, by their own nature, environmentally unfriendly. We do this through research collaborations with various institutions in the United States and Australia. And once again, our role is really to inform government. That interdepartmental task team that exists, which is led by DMR, our role is to support them by providing them with that information so that they can take those decisions and pass them on to Cabinet so that Cabinet can allow for the safe and cost-effective exploration and production and use of shale gas as it moves forward. And that work plan has been made available to DOE and to DMR, and we are awaiting the approval, as I said earlier, from DMR. I'd just like to touch, before the CFO comes on board to answer some of the questions, I think I just need to explain how the unspent funds came about. Everything that we're given from the fiscus that is designed for us gets spent. Absolutely nothing. And it's not about 52% of women being there to spend it. It's actually because all of the programs under our control, we disperse the funds and everything happens. Where we have unspent funds comes about in two cases. First of all, the carbon capture and storage pilot. The project by nature does not happen over 1 year. It's a 4, 5-year, 6-year program at the end of the day. Unfortunately, and somewhat fortunately, we were given the money through National Treasury, but we cannot disburse all of it because the CapEx is only required in 2017. But we needed that money now to get the money out of the World Bank. So that $27 million that we've leveraged from them and the 30 million rands, which has just come through from the Norwegian government, it's only been given to South Africa because the South African government has put 190 million more or less into this program already of its own. And that is the good thing, is that we needed that money to get there. Unfortunately, it reflects badly on your financials when you see unspent funds, but that's not the reality. The fact is we cannot spend those funds yet. The second project is the EU-funded project, which is on smart metering.
That project requires us to install various technologies and do various studies in 9 municipalities. Because we could not get a business case approved, and it comes down to, as I said, many stakeholders involved in this process, not just us. We cannot get the approved business case in place during the financial year. The RDP funds have to go back into the RDP fund. That's how it works. But you get it back because you know that there's a plan and Treasury and everybody else is happy, so that money comes straight back to us. That unspent fund that you would see, at least 70 million of that, came straight back from the RDP fund because the project is there. So this week, the municipalities have sat down with us. We've agreed contractually to everything, and the project is started. So by the end of this financial year, you will actually see the projects rolling out in these 9 municipalities. But unfortunately, you only see the unspent funds component sitting there in the annual report. And I think I just needed to highlight that, Chair, as to where unspent funds come about. They are ring-fenced, and unfortunately, once the funds have been ring-fenced by Treasury or the donor, you cannot use them. So we will show you at a subsequent presentation all the various programs, what they're funded with, and if they have sufficient funds or not. If they don't have sufficient funds, then this committee should take a decision. How can it help in the case of energy efficiency? How can it help to spearhead the next intervention? Cogeneration is a good example. There is no money at the moment for cogeneration. The cogeneration framework, as announced or should be announced by the minister, has been delayed. We've gone through two minister changes in the course of about a year, but that's okay because the bottom line is you want certainty in that call once the RFPs come out. Now, we have to wait until the RFP comes out for us to be able to support a process. What we're trying to do in parallel is to work with Treasury and SARS and say, can we introduce a tax incentive for technologies under 5 megawatts? So we can use a tax incentive as the basis to promote cogeneration because there's huge potential. But we will have to wait for the framework to come out for the larger projects under the rebuild program. With respect to the lease commitments for our building, the point that was made about buying our own building, that's absolutely true. We're in the process of evaluating those options. The cheapest option that came out for us was to buy, was to have a building constructed in the same office complex where we're in Grayston, which is the same complex that SET is in. The cost, I think, was in the region of about 40, do you remember offhand, 46 million. We worked out that if Treasury gave us an extra 20 million, we'd be able to amortize it cost effectively over 20 years using the same payments as we're paying now on our current leases. So it's a decision that has to be taken by our board in consultation with National Treasury. But the idea is, in fact, to go for our own building rather than to keep leasing. There was a question raised about the IEP. We can't comment on the IEP. The IEP is government-approved plans. The role of in terms of renewable energy is earmarked in the context of 26.3%. It may seem high, but if you look at the progress that's been made so far in the first 2 rounds of the REBIT program, we really have 4,000 megawatts that's been put onto the system from renewables. Now, 4,000 based on the current system is almost 10%. So it's not inconceivable that you can get 26.3% by 2030 if you keep going at the same rate of implementation. So we're convinced that the IEP is achievable. The question is, what else do we have to do in parallel with that to make sure that we have the right skills and the localization in place to do that? There was an issue raised about staff numbers. In order for us to be more efficient, we have to introduce more and more contract people in terms of limited duration contracts. So all of us, including myself, are on contracts because the most efficient way of getting people to work is by having them on 3 or 5 year contracts, which is renewable. But they have to perform over that time frame. And so this is a general trend in industry in any case, is to get people to move them onto contracts rather than have them as permanent employees. So it does not detract, in fact, from the level of support that we're getting. In fact, it makes it better because we're able to look more into the market and see where skills exist and where we can develop more and more skills. So as I said to you earlier, the staff complement, if you look at the technical advisors that are supported by the international donors, as well as all our interns, volunteers, and everybody, the numbers are over 60, well over 60 people that are housed in that complex. And so the numbers start to add up in terms of what you've got in terms of the building. 52% of women applies to the entire company. It does not just apply to senior management. The numbers are different for senior management. In terms of what we're doing about Indians and coloreds, I fly the flag for colored males. Unfortunately, there's only one. We had another one, unfortunately, another senior manager. He passed away in service in 2010. But it comes down to having the right access to skills. We have we've had one senior black female resign. She's actually joined CIF. And it's about mobility in the sense that she moved to PwC and then came back to CIF. She's able to do that effectively because her skills are in demand. So, yes, we've managed to get a good CFO from the AG, and we've retained another PhD, black female PhD. But it's about growing those numbers at the management level. That is our next priority. But 52% applies to all women across the board in the company. Okay, I'm going to ask you to maybe come in here on the issues, perhaps on the financial misconduct, perhaps.
Just on the issue of the irregular expenditure, I just want to clarify what I said when I was going through the slides. I said our intention is just to keep the trend going. We actually want to get to a point where we come to this committee and we have no irregular expenditure to report at all. That's what I meant, that we want to keep the same trend, we want to keep going down, we want to come back next year with nothing issues. But unfortunately, we have controls in place, we have policies in place. For example, we can have safeguards that we put in place, and we can have an individual perhaps who does not adhere to the safeguards, and we have our policy empowers us to take action as required by the PFMA against those individuals. So the intention at Sanedi is to make sure that we actually come back to this committee with no irregular expenditure, but what we can assure you is we've put measures in place to make sure that whenever irregular expenditure has been identified, we take action against whoever it is that has taken or has resulted in the organization incurring irregular expenditure. It is stated in our policy that if you incur irregular expenditure, this is the consequences, this will be disciplinary action and so forth. So it's not our intention to keep the status quo. The status quo is unacceptable. We cannot keep having irregular expenditure being reported. But I also just want to clarify and say, what kind of irregular expenditure are we talking about? We are not talking about irregular expenditure where there's been fraudulent activities. We're talking about process issues. We're talking about where somebody has gone out and bought lunch for the board and procured it from a service provider who didn't have a tax clearance. And then we found ourselves in a situation where that transaction has been regarded as being irregular. We're talking about somebody going out on tender because, for example, like I've indicated, people who didn't have an understanding of Section 3A regulations, they'll go out on open tender, or we can do it for 17 days because we want quicker turnaround times, not knowing if you're going to shorten the period of a tender, it has to be pre-approved first by the right authority, and then you can go out on open tender for those number of days. So we have resolved that through our policies, through centralizing our procurement. So we are happy that we won't kind of have those kind of issues coming back to this committee where it has to go through procurement, the procurement department, or it has to go through myself or Kevin for approval, because we made sure that everything is stated, people are trained, and people understand what they're doing. Unfortunately, just on the action plans, we do have an action plan that we've drafted. We've also, like the chairperson said, we circulated the board audit committee for comment, for reviews, for if ever they feel there needs to be improvement, they do that. There is an action plan, and that action plan actually speaks to how we are going to address the procurement issues and also highlight some of the challenges. For example, if somebody deliberately bypasses procurement process, unfortunately that's something that we cannot foresee, or we don't have direct control over, or it didn't go through our procurement processes. So that particular case, if ever it results in regular expenditure, like I said, there will be consequences for that. So that is made clear. And then just on the issue of financial misconduct, I do agree with you when you say irregular expenditure is considered to be financial misconduct. And if you look at the definition of financial misconduct, it's actually quite broad because it actually also speaks to non-adherence to policies and procedures. So it is a broad subject. But I think what we were trying to highlight, we actually do not have financial misconduct from fraudulent activities. As such, not that we don't have irregular expenditure. Irregular expenditure by its own, yes, there is financial misconduct. And the action plans for the cases that we are dealing with, it's, for for example, like I said, the SPDs not being obtained, the tax clearances not being obtained, all of those require us to just strengthen and tighten our controls in terms of procurement, and that we have done. We are conducting like regular reviews. We have a regular expenditure register that we keep. We're conducting regular reviews of anything that in our eyesight, when we look at it, just looks like somebody didn't follow process. We will follow it up, we'll investigate, we'll get the answers, and if it is found that it is possibly or is irregular, the other stage that we've introduced in the whole process is that it will go to a legal person to review to say, can we take legal action to recover the money? If ever the legal opinion says no, we can't for the following legal reasons, then the next step will be disciplinary action, but not necessarily recovering the money because we'll be guided by the legal opinion that we have. So I'm not sure if ever you answered or you still have.
Thanks, Chair. With your permission, I'd just like to continue and answer some of the other questions. There were quite a few questions. One of them relates to the company secretary issue. We fully agree the appointment of the company secretary is an issue. It's a process that's been going on for at least 6 to 8 months. We've had 3 rounds of appointments. We've had 3 rounds of interviews at least. Through different service providers, we've managed to find a few candidates for various reasons unable to appoint them. We're now in the process where we've gone headhunting for a company secretary. So certainly there's an intention on our part to utilize a company secretary as quickly as possible. It's something that the board itself has impressed on us as management to make sure happens as quickly as possible. And so as I said, the process has been going on for 6 to 8 months. Having identified suitable candidates only to find that we can't afford them, firstly, and secondly, that the candidates themselves have disqualified themselves through some activity on their part which was not shared with us. So you go through all the interviews, ultimately end up with the candidates, and then they either disqualify themselves or you end up not being able to afford them, unfortunately, as was the case in the first instance. So we're headhunting currently for a company secretary and hoping to appoint one very soon. So the issue around a code of ethics, we accept, of course, that that should be a part of the report. We do include that in our quarterly reports to government. Unfortunately, not in this particular report, and we take notes of that issue, and we'll attempt to, of course, include that in subsequent reports to this committee. I think we've discussed the issue around procurement in great detail. I hope I didn't create the wrong impression about CIF when I spoke earlier. Our biggest challenge with CIF is that CIF is a Schedule 2 company, we're Schedule 3. They do things differently to us. It's not a case of blaming CIF. It's a case that they're a different type of entity to what we are now. We've been transformed into a Schedule 3 entity. So what works for CIF doesn't necessarily always work for us. That's the case in procurement. And that's the reality of things. And so what we're saying is that we needed to introduce our own IT systems, our own HR management function, our own procurement system, because by nature we are different types of entities. And so I hope I didn't create the wrong impression about CIF's capabilities at all. I hope that wasn't the understanding. So the issue around senior managers and KPIs, we always attempt to make sure that our objectives are considered to be smart, specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. Sometimes, most of the time, we get it right. In fact, we got Ernst & Young to come in and sit down with us, and they were 100% happy with everything that we did, only to find out from the AG that they weren't happy with everything that they saw. So now we've gone back to Ernst & Young and said, what have you done? But in our opinion, our senior managers did what they thought was best. So obviously, we've learned a lot out of that exercise, and now we're going through our new strat planning session, which is in November. And in that process, we will all go through a refresher, but at the same time, we will make sure that it does get done better. And we've asked the AG to also assist, and having somebody from the AG previously on board helps us to get there a lot quicker. So I think I've touched on co-generation in a sense. You know, our role is to wait until government introduces the RFP, but in essence, we're trying to push very hard for the small players who have up to 5 megawatts available and who can roll them out in a very short period of time. And together with GIZ, who's really pushing hard because the Germans have done such good work in Germany using cogeneration as a tool that they would like to see us being able to implement the same kind of project. So they're definitely trying to support that. So yes, the rollover issue is a concern for us because we have to apply for rollovers every year. It's not automatic. There's no automatic approvals. So you have to go and apply for rollover, and then it's up to Treasury to decide if they want to give you back your money or not. So it's an undesirable situation for us. But bearing in mind the nature of R&D as well, is such that you're not guaranteed a result in a particular year. So innovation in R&D is a very difficult space because you can't plan for an outcome on a particular date. We're not in a sales environment, unfortunately. So in our case, we have to go back to treasury in some cases. More often than not, it comes down to better planning, and we're learning as we're going along, and we're hopefully getting better and better as we do this. I think we've spoken about localization and the fact that we're sitting in a constrained environment where we're pushing for at least 70% localization by the time we get to, let's say, around 4 or around 5 in the rebirth process, because we believe that is achievable, that you can get up to 70% quite easily. And that is the goal that we have in mind. The way we're doing it is to partner with the private sector, set up a company, a subsidiary, that can generate intellectual property, work with the private sectors who are manufacturing, and allow for specific standardized components to be manufactured in the country, which must be taken up by project developers as they bid under the VBID program. We believe that's a nice cost-effective way of getting us to the point where localization is increased. There was an issue raised about we don't tell you enough about how we're doing in terms of our objectives. Well, the AG has audited that, and we believe that it's between 78% and 80% of our objectives have been met. So that's the audited figure. We could have an entirely separate discussion about how effective that 80% is, because I think it comes down to what Parliament or what the Department realistically wants to see as an outcome of that process. And for us, it's about making sure that skills are in place, making sure that technologies are on the ground, making sure that universities are capacitated to generate innovation and make sure that it's there. We're not a commercial player. We don't have the bank balances of the IDCs or others to be able to finance or give grants out in the orders of hundreds of millions of rand. So we make do with the funds that we have, and we do a good job of leveraging. So we go out and we take 1 rand from the state, and we get 1 or 2 rands from private sector or from donors, so that we can put together a bigger, better project and use their expertise to make that happen. So that's part of the kind of thing we're good at, and that's what we will keep doing until, of course, the budgets get better and bigger. So what kind of support do we need? We'll hopefully show you at the next available opportunity which areas are underfunded, and there are areas that are underfunded, and then hopefully use your influence to motivate that some areas, like any broader energy efficiency, needs to be supported better, that it does get money. For instance, green transport. This is Transport Month. We know there's a big push towards getting more and more use of public transport, but what about the personal transportation options? How much greener can we make them? That's what we're busy with now. We're working with BMW to help them to fast-track the rollout of electric vehicles in the country with the i3, BMW, and as well as the Nissan Leaf. We're working with the city of Joburg to make sure we can take gas and actually start powering buses using natural gas, biogas, in fact. We're looking at ways and means of getting the taxi industries, and we're looking at 100,000 taxis. 100,000 taxis being converted to run on LPG or on compressed natural gas as well as petrol. That's the objective that's now being set internally. So these are big plans on the transport side, but they do require some additional assistance. And we're not coming to the committee to say we don't have money, we can't do anything. No, we're showing you what we can do with the resources that we've got. And we're saying have the faith in us to motivate for more funding so that we can do more. And we won't come crying to the committee, because the bottom line is we believe the committee is there to support us as much as we're here to support Parliament and the Department and make sure you can meet your own objectives as well. So I'm going to conclude, Chairperson, just in 1 second. The issue was about energy efficiency. Honourable Member mentioned about energy efficiency and integration. So our Chairperson, who unfortunately couldn't be here now, as well as the Deputy Minister, she's also asked that there be more integration from a Seneti perspective. So we're convening a conference of sorts in February of 2015. And at that event, we are going to bring together the donors, the government departments and the agencies that are involved in that space, and the private sector participants that either participate or benefit from those exercises, and come up with a coherent strategy that talks about how, firstly, integration happens, and secondly, what role Seneti plays in the areas where there are gaps, and how we can actually fill those gaps with funding either from IDM, which is the old ESCOM funding, or through different interventions such as tax incentives that can be made available. So that's the goal, February of this coming year, and by then we should have a clear strategy and a path towards getting us there. And then just lastly, in terms of the alignment, in our strategy planning exercise, we always start off with the major policies and plans of governments that shape the work we do. So we start off, like I mentioned earlier in the presentation, about State of the Nation Address, the budget vote speeches of the Minister and the Deputy, as well as the Chairperson of this committee. We look at the National Development Plan, we look at the IEP, the IRP, and our strategic outcomes are based on those plans. And from there, the cascades out. So the annual performance plan that comes to you for approval at the end of the day is really based on what we see coming out of there that's relevant to us. So I think, Chair, I've tried to answer most of the questions. I apologize if I've left out any important salient matters. The transformation issues in numbers, as I said, is an ongoing process. We will build up those skills. We take on as many of the interns as we can that come to us. And so far, we've had very good interns coming through the system, and we'll hopefully keep more and more of them employed throughout the years. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks very much, Senator. Any follow-up comments, questions? None at all. Okay. I'm sure, Sanedi, you did hear some of the strong sentiments expressed by the members. So we do understand. There are some factual things. One of the things is that relative to other entities, so this one is 2 years old, more or less, or just over that. And the other factual thing is it is a fact that some of the functions that we can't now hold them accountable because those functions didn't actually lie with them. It's a factual thing. Whether they would have done it better, we can't tell. But the truth is that was not with them. So I think members have expressed the views that they have expressed. We agree that we need a follow-up discussion to deal with the areas of weaknesses that have been identified because we want to see a stronger SANED. There's no question about that, so that we need it and that it has got to perform its work better. So we'll come back to that, having taken into account the views members expressed earlier on. But thank you very much for the answers you have provided. So we'll have our discussion and then we will make a decision on how to deal with the issues that the members raised about how to have another conversation with you to help you strengthen the areas of weakness. Thanks very much. My target half past four.
Yeah.
No, I haven't. Thanks very much. See you tomorrow. We start in 9 o'clock, honorable members. Thanks. Yeah, yes, like, it's a beauty.
Thank you.